Welcome back to It Feels Right. This week we have Rob, myself, and Adam Stone is here in the studio with us. Thank God. I've missed him and I want him here every week. And we have so much to cover. We have everything from the MLP draft, which completed, Premier and Challenger. We're going to cover some of Adam's picks with the hard eights and some other picks in the draft. And we are also going to get into
the tip of the day, mixing your paces. That GM hot seat, that's a real thing, Rob. So we got a lot to cover in this episode, and we do go through quite a bit of those things. So enjoy.
Let's get in.
Because you know why?
Why?
Because it feels right.
It feels right. Legendary.
Ladies and gents, before we hop into the show, I do want to talk to you a little bit about Selkirk's amazing line of pickleball nets. And whether you're just starting out or you're a seasoned pro, Selkirk has the perfect net for you. When you choose a Selkirk net, you're not just choosing any net, you're opting for the official net of the PPA Tour, where excellence meets professional play. With Selkirk's line of nets, you can play pickleball anywhere. Selkirk's range of nets caters to every player's needs, offering budget-friendly choices for casual enthusiasts and premium options for those with a competitive edge that are looking for more of the pro-level net. So either way, you're ensuring quality play for all levels, and I've got a Selkirk net for myself, and let me tell you, it's a game changer. It's all about playing on your terms wherever you are, whether it's the driveway or on the PPA Tour. So if you love pickleball as much as I do, and we do here at It Feels Right podcast, check out Selkirk's pickleball nets. Get the freedom to play anywhere and everywhere and elevate your game with the net trusted by the pros. Selkirk's got you covered. If you're interested in getting a net of your own, go to selkirk.com/collection/nets, and we'll link to that in the show notes. You can also find this link in the description of the show. But let's jump into this week's episode of It Feels Right with Robin Stone. Are you ready for that today?
Is this like a nature nurture type situation or what?
Oh, not big on nature, yeah. The hat. No, nature, it's nurture? I was talking to Josh, producer Josh, before you got on in that small window we had before you joined us. And it's from a show.
Large window.
It's from a show called Love on the Spectrum, which is actually incredible. It's so good. It's basically the autism spectrum. So it's you have people with autism that are basically matching up and trying to find love. And there's this one guy named Connor, who I believe is from Atlanta, Georgia. And he's like he talks in a British accent half the time, but he's the man. And he was in a speed dating type situation where he was sitting in front, like basically sitting head on with a lady, and they're sitting down and they're very direct with each other. And he's just like, he's like, do you like nature? And she's like, no, don't like nature. And he has a little piece of paper. So he starts writing, you know, right after she responds, and the paper has yes, no notes. So he marks a big X and no right in front of her, and then writes not big on nature in the notes. And then sees him writing like, no, not interested in her, like just directly like in this conversation. And she's just like, and the producer's like, Connor, did you do that right in front of her? And he's like, oh, should I not do that? And they're like, yeah, you should probably wait. It's just like a good line, not big on nature. And then here's the X marking through it. Mm. So wow, just love on the spectrum, baby.
That's quite a story. And I have scrolled through that. I have not clicked on it yet.
Watch it, Adam.
Okay. All right. I've watched 68% of Netflix, so I got to find a new show. So why not go that route? So
Love on the Spectrum. They have an Australian version. They have a U.S. version. There's plenty of content for you to consume.
But he didn't. I mean, he just didn't want to forget. He was making his notes in the moment. You know, I get that. Yeah, I mean, you 100%. Can't. I mean, you wait a little bit longer, he might forget. He might have checked yes, and we can't have that when it's a no.
No, I mean, he could have, yeah, but that's the thing. Just incredibly direct and straightforward, not going to play any games. It's, no, you're out. You're not big, yeah, not big on nature, no.
It's probably the way to speed date, actually. Maybe this guy's got something figured out, to be honest with you. No yep. sense in dilly-dallying or giving false hope to anyone. Why don't you just lift up dreams or crush dreams right in the moment and get on your way for everybody. Works for everyone.
it's going to work or it's not, and this is not going to work. Sorry.
Love that. Love that. So, well, what a way to start the show.
I mean, got to just support, got to support the show, Love on the Spectrum out there with the hat. So cheers to Connors.
I mean, we're probably going to roll about 45 minutes or an hour today. I think I might just jump right on the TV.
I love it. Yeah, there you go. We had a lot. Dude, there's so much going on. We had the APP that I was at this past weekend down in Delray Beach. We had the Raleigh or Cary, North Carolina PPA. We had the MLP draft that concluded. We've had a little bit of a – we've had the first trade in MLP already happen. So lots to cover. I don't know how much we're going to get into all of it, but we're going to at least go through the highlights.
Yeah, well, we've been on trying to make a point of emphasis to keep shows under an hour. And if we talk about everything, it's going to be about 3 hours. So we'll chop it up. We'll chop it up in some fashion. But, man, it was a very intense week. I did a bit of commentary, the drafts, of course, both Premier and Challenger. I had pretty much heavy brow sweat working throughout the week as my sleep hours were low and my intensity was high. So enjoyed all of it. You know, I'm a pickle guy, but I am glad for the drafts to be over. They're pretty dang stressful, and it's just a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. The player pools are deep. There's a lot of factors, two different varieties of drafts. So there's a lot of variables and a lot of phone calls were going on and making sure I'm on the same page with owners and things like this. So it was fun but intense.
Your last men's pick and challenger is Purple Jesus, Max.
PJM, that's right.
PJM. Who else were you considering? Obviously Eric, you know, had a large influence on that pick, I'm assuming, and was really probably heavily advocating for PJM. Who else was under consideration for that last men's pick?
Oh man, there's a variety of players. I mean, there's probably 10-ish or so players in a tier. And, you know, especially, you know, the SoCal Hard Eights going with full-on rock-solid veteran experience and Irina Tereshchenko and Eric Lang with the first two picks, finding, a couple players that had a high ceiling was something that I think paired well with them. So Christine Maddox and Purple Jesus Manthau kind of fell into that. And I know it's been a big point of contention talking about, or at least on Twitter, talking about GMs and owners talking to players after they're drafted to see if they have a preference or, and I'm a bit both ways on it. And, you know, this is super generalized, but the player really matters. So, certainly Eric was advocating for his boy. He had several reasons why there was reason to think that this Max Manthau could improve and get better. We had intel from a couple other areas as well, which intel that we trusted from people that we trusted that corroborated what Eric was saying. So, you know, if it was just, hey, pick my boy from the PNW, you know, it's a little more elaborate than that. So, you had Yates Johnson, you had Callan Dawson, you had Eric Palit, you had a handful of other people that have had some rock solid success. And given all of our information from about 9 different places, we decided to take a crack at Purple Jesus. He clearly has a nice rapport with Eric Lang. Irina knows him from the PMW. And there is a couple reasons, like I said, to think that he can make a solid jump early in the season or in the heart of the season to even improve an already very quality level that he's playing at.
Yeah, I think, look, I don't think there's any reason to doubt the Hard Eights at this point, right? Until you guys give us reason to, you know, question you. At this point, there hasn't been any questioning because you guys just keep winning, and not just winning, but like dominating. So, it's true. So I think, yeah, dude, I think PJM's a great pick because I think the upside's really there. And I don't think he's, when he's had obviously good partners, the results have been there. I don't think he's had any high quality or, you know, upper tiered partners on the mix side, but he's not a big guy, but he is very fast, can play the left really well, cover a lot of court, which bodes well for mixed, bodes well for singles, obviously has good men's results with Eric. So I think, you know, that low in the drafts, it's a high quality pick. And I think it's a good mix for you guys because it's really what you want. You want like a rock solid, you know, a couple rock solid veterans also paired with some good upside. And I think for MLP, Eric is a good, he's a good leader. He will take it very professionally. He will be a great teammate. He will, he's just going to be a great supporter. And I think it's going to be solid for you guys. Yeah, my money's on you guys in the Challenger.
No, I'm pretty happy with it. And also another thing to note, I talked about the player matters. I mean, I think that Eric is probably top five or so player whose judgment I would trust. He's a full-on adult. He thinks in a quality, analytical, logical way. Granted, his suggestion is probably 10 or 15% of the reason why. I told you there was a lot of reasons why going this route, I think, made sense. So when you factor in what I said about Eric, his encouraging us to do so, and the intel in a variety of different areas, even in different parts of the country, not just in that PNW section, which I think does happen a lot, where South Florida guys love South Florida guys, Arizona guys love Arizona guys and gals, and vice versa. With the diversity of intel coming in, we pulled the trigger, and it wasn't an easy trigger to pull. I'm not just going to say it was just like, oh, Purple Jesus all the way. We had the brain trust. We had a couple boys in the war room chatting things over. Of course, Tim Parks, Rick Chan, and the crew. So, these drafts are never easy. It's never just clear cut, except for an occasional pick where that's exactly where you want to go. We had our, you know, we had a couple picks stolen from us, or a couple players that, you know, we were thinking would be a good fit, and it just didn't make it back to us through that snake draft process. So it's intense, man. And I just like where the dominoes fell, and I'm pretty happy with our squad and excited for the season.
Did Irina have any influence on the Christian Maddox pick?
No. So that was someone else who was very high on that upside and that physical presence, high-end tennis background, five-star recruit, a couple chats on the phone and quality interactions and a good mindset of where she's at in her career and her, you know, just desire and ability to continue to improve, all played into that pick. Yes.
What results, because I don't know, what results has she had that led you guys to believe, on top of obviously your conversations with her and all of that, led you to believe that she would be a quality pick and challenger?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a results perspective. It's seen her play a few times and the whole package of what it is. So I think you need to be dipping from a variety of places with your information and your reasoning. So if you're just going by results, or you are looking at who they have partnered with and who they have played, like, there is just so many factors more than we beat this team 11-8, 11-8, or we lost to this team in three. It's hard to exactly put your finger on it when you have clearly a handful of players that have been playing longer with more consistent results than someone with pretty legitimate upside that does not necessarily have those results. And it's a tear, man. You're really torn. Yeah. It's like, this player, you know exactly what you're going to get. I've watched this player play 74 times. I know that they have probably already played their best pickleball and that is in the rearview mirror, even though they're still a very good player. How do you balance that out with someone who does not have the results, who has not been playing as long, but has great physical skills and the drive and the ability to get better? There literally is not a perfect recipe. I've said it's tough 7 times and I'll make it 8. It's tough.
But I've seen her play singles, and she seems incredibly athletic, moves really well, can hit the ball. I haven't seen, but like, there has to be some kind of level of doubles results where it's been like, oh, okay. Like, she's like, have you seen her play doubles, or have you seen like some decent results from doubles, or is it literally going off like pretty blind upside?
I mean, blind upside is probably the wrong word, but yeah, it's mostly potential at this point. She's buddies with Jilly B, Jill Braverman, played a couple tournaments together. I know Jill had a slight injury, and I actually called her match, but of course she's playing Catherine and Anna Lee. Sure. Pretty tough competitors to draw too many conclusions from that. So
yeah,
it's a bit of tape work, it's a bit of word of mouth, and it's a bit of physical tools at disposal. And of course, that you know, I don't care what anyone says. If you're a 5-star recruit with racket sport background at a high level, that's not just a physical thing. That's a mindset thing and a mental game as well. You've been on big stages in your career playing for the Pepperdine Waves. And yeah, I mean, I you know, I would be lying if I said I've watched her play 10 times and I know scrolled through every single draw and knew all of the results she's had in her career. I didn't. I had pieces of information from a variety of places, and I put those pieces together. We put those pieces together. You know, as I had a couple picks in this draft where it was sort of me leading the charge, and Tim Parks is in the mix, man. He for someone who did not play at a high level and still doesn't play at a high level. That's right, Tim.
to be clear,
he is in the know. He thinks about the game the right way, and even more importantly, he has his tentacles out talking to the right people who do know the game better than he does, and he is a good judge of who to listen to and not to listen to, which is huge. These challenger picks, I mean, I'm in the mix as anyone, and I don't have a ton of just firsthand experience with a lot of these players that are on the draft board. So I think that's one of the hugest things when you're evaluating is listening to the right people and knowing who thinks about things the right way and isn't going to play favorites or give you some sort of, you know, not BS information, but clouded information for whatever reason that may be, personal something or this and that. So that's a roundabout way of saying I'm not 100% full on knowing everything about these players, so I have to trust other people to give me and kind of fill in the pieces that I don't have.
Who is the main person you trusted in respect to that pick? Who is giving you the most boots on the ground info?
We're digging deep here, and I think I'd probably just squash that. You've already put me on the hot seat with a couple of your questions there, Mr. Rainstorm. So
I'm just trying to get some of the behind the scenes draft process. This is fun.
Yeah, I mean, I've basically given information without giving any information so far.
That's why I keep asking, because you've said nothing.
I know, and I've thought I've done a decent job of that. And, you know, I mean, we're getting, you know, and this could very well be the last draft. So, if I knew we had another draft in a few months, I probably wouldn't have given you I gave nothing, but that's where I'm at, and that's all what right. I'm willing to give at this
Fair.
Point. So
what are your thoughts on the, and yeah, I like how this is turning into Adam on the hot seat, but this is no more heart aches, but what are your thoughts with the St. Louis Shock? I think one of the more surprising picks was the St. Louis Shock drafting Kate Fahey with their second women's pick. What are your thoughts on that one?
And I have heard that she is, I mean, I don't know a lot about her. I don't think anybody does. I've heard she is an elite competitor, like high-end competitive spirit, which of course pairs well with Anna Bright. And so it's hard to judge Anna Bright too much. She's obsessed with the sport. She likes to talk strategy and find those diamonds in the rough. Not that Rachel Rohrabacher was an unknown commodity. She was much more known at the time than Kate Fahey.
Yeah.
But there was a bit of a reach from where she went going premier in that draft. So what I would say about that pick is she clearly did it for a reason, but is she possibly thinking, hey, I struck lightning in a bottle with Rachel Rohrabacher. Am I going to go out of the comfort zone or out of whatever and try to make that happen again and kind of force it? So I don't know exactly. I don't have enough information on this player. I know she had some quality results with John Cincola and Austin and mixed doubles, had a couple nice wins. But in terms of on paper, that's all I really know about her. So was this – you know, Anna getting exactly what she wanted or possibly trying to force another Rohrabacher situation. I'm not exactly sure. We're going to have to see. But if you look at the patterns of some of the teams that have had success, they get massive value from their third and fourth round picks. Or they, if you go plain and you go vanilla, sure, you can have that come together and work out well. But if you get second round value in a fourth round pick, that is just such a big deal. And you know, we had that with, you know, our ladies played great last year in the Hard Eights and Yana Newell and Eva Radzikowska. But I mean, we got insane value with CJ Klinger in the third round and Todd Fote in the fourth round. And you know, I think that's what got us over the hump to have consistent success in that season.
So I'm not sure if the Fahey pick was necessarily led by Anna Bright and a hand selected pick or if it was just a GM kind of ownership selection based on what they've seen. But it is interesting because, like you mentioned before, the player versus GM debate of who should have those picks and who should be leading those picks is an interesting one, because you want, like, pickleball is unique. You want players to jive. You want to, you know, you want to have good team chemistry, and you don't really know that unless the players have experience or the players know each other. So it's tough. It goes both ways. These are small teams. You know, you're not picking a team of 10 people where the team has to, like, where everybody's not going to be close, and you're going to have to build team chemistry. Like, it's a team of four. Like, you have to have team chemistry right out of the gate. Really, it's hard to develop that with just such a small team. So what I think, and I would like to see GMs be more responsible for picks. I think you're always going to have player input with such small teams, and can't get away from that.
Yeah, I just don't think we're really at a stage where GMs are going to be able to do that. I totally get the argument. You don't want biased information from players. I understand. But almost all of these GMs are not players. The talent pool is drastically changing at all times. I mean, like, you know, we're talking Major League Baseball or NBA. It is what it is. Like, you know, you have a great idea. There's not just some guy that comes out of nowhere or some girl that comes out of nowhere and is amazing. And in pickleball, that is very much a thing right now. And it might be 5, 7, 8 years before that player pool is so tight that, and there's information, enough information on everyone for these non-player GMs to make that call. So I think that in theory, it is good for the GMs to make the call and do almost everything with the draft without input in the moment from the players. But I don't think we're anywhere near that, to be honest with you. The players know they've been on court. The players even have more information and talking in circles and local groups of play that they know kind of the stars rising more than the GMs. And I don't think there's hardly any GMs really technically qualified to be doing what they're doing. Yeah. And that,
other than yourself, I would say. And truly.
Right. I mean, a little bit.
Because you've been on court. It's recently. It's not like 5 years ago. You're commentating. You're watching a ton of pickle. You understand nuances. You understand. Yeah. I mean, I think there's. But again, you're in a very unique position of being really, truly one of the only top players that no longer plays, but also commentates and coaches and is super involved with the game. There's just literally nobody else that is in your position.
No, I do agree with that in this moment, but at the same time, even just whatever it is, 18, 20 to 24 months that since I've played, like that in itself, I haven't been on court with a lot of the new wave. You know what I'm saying? So I'm very, very confident with my skill set and where I'm at in the game of pickleball. But at the same time, it's not like it was a year ago. So
you've been on with Schick and Sock, and you've seen the speed, you've seen the spin, so you do get an idea of like how the game's changed technologically with the paddles and how fast it's gotten and what you can do with it.
But there's a whole new wave that I have not been on court with, and I have not played in a competitive situation. So it's special times, and I just don't think whether they're extremely intelligent, logical thinkers, kind of like MLB GMs have gone, where almost none of them are players anymore. These are like data. number statistics. Crunching data guys. One, we don't have data like they have, and two, a lot of these GMs, whether they're titans of life and crushing, business, a lot of them don't know about pickleball and how it works and the patterns and the situations and the small sample size that you have to sift through. They just don't know. And so I'm trusting players in a lot of situations as kind of a tiebreaker, kind of like, whatever. Singles is just, You're drafting two players as doubles players. Singles is like a tiebreaker for me. It's not like massively playing into the pick. And I think that player evaluations and players talking about players is more of a tiebreaker situation than like something I'm going to 100% trust. So we're just not there yet in the infancy of the sport to know for these GMs to be making like big time decisions with no input from other stuff. So that's where I stand on it.
Yeah. And curious to hear, what everybody listening and watching thinks. Would love to let us know in the comments, because it's interesting, because there's a lot of, you see people in the Discord and the chats and stuff like that who, call it Heyshay. She has been a huge Augie fan for a long time and has been saying he's going to be really good. And I mean, he's developed really quickly and he's got a lot of confidence and he's playing super well and just got to a championship Sunday. Same with Jaume. Those guys have come a long way in doubles and not a very long period of time. And I think it's cool that Jaume is a little underrated in doubles. His hands and resets, and he's not a big guy and he's playing the left really well. Which you don't see super often, similar to PJM that you guys have. Pretty cool that, I think it's moving to the, you look at the next gen team for the APP, all those guys are like 6'5". They're like, Spencer Lanier, Richard Livernese, you got Jaden Broderick, these guys are, they're big kids. And the reach and what they can do from the kitchen, it's cool to see that, the smaller guys are still going to have a place and still going to have success, because I think the game will eventually move to the big guys, but there's going to be ways where the little guys can still stay super relevant and dubs.
Yeah. And I'm going back. That was a lovely thought, Robert. I'm going back to data. We have real clear stats. They're doing their thing, trying to put together information. And I think that information is valuable, but I also think that information is noisy right now in the infancy of our sport. So I don't think a lot of these GMs are player evaluators at all. Like they don't quite exactly know what to look for. Now, I have no doubt that they can analyze data, and they can, if we had enough quality data like they do in other professional sports. And until we get to that point where there is just a plethora of data to sift through and figure out in a variety of situations, I think that players evaluate players than current front office people in pickleball.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, data is tough in pickle because it's so nuanced. You have the dynamics of partners and getting isolated, and it's like we're talking, you know, your partner leaves a ball up a little high, it gets flicked at you at the perfect spot, you know, you get tangled up. That error's on the person that got tangled up, right? Even though the person that left the ball a little high, it should be on them. I mean, and that's just, it's just tough to gauge because, like, what's the metric? Like, is it was an inch too high? It was, you know, on some players that have good rolls and good flicks, you know, it's very nuanced. And I think what would be cool is if, you know, is if rating systems would move towards separating mixed and men's as well. I think there's right now in terms of ratings, it's pretty generalized. How much did you guys look at ratings in terms of the draft, Adam? Like, were you still looking at, like, not really at all, right? Like, not so much.
Yeah, very, very middling amount, maybe yeah. even less than that. So it just changes so fast. And you bring up a good point too, Rob. It's like your partner leaves a third relatively high. Some 6'6 guy crushes a roll at the partner's left foot in the midcourt, and that goes down as an unforced error. Is that an unforced error? No, that is a forced error. And it's so hard to sift through. I mean, we have whatever exit velocity in baseball. You know the rotations of the pitcher throwing the ball. You know the miles per hour that he's throwing. They even have little things in the bats to talk about bat speed. That is, like, for sure absolute information. And there is so little of that in pickleball because of a variety of reasons. So you have to be careful there. I do think that there is value in some of these stats. You just have to know where the big chunks of value are in the numbers and what is kind of noisy and doesn't matter that much. And that's going to be tough for at least the short term, if not possibly longer.
Yeah, and I'd argue that not even a forced error in that situation where your partner leaves a hanging third pretty high, and yeah, you get hit into the midcourt. I would almost say that's an unforced error on the person hitting the drop, right? So it's like, yeah, I mean, that's another argument, right? Like, if somebody hits a terrible third shot lob, like, just as a bailout, and it just gets hit for, like, that's a, in my eyes, that's an unforced error on the person that hit the lob or the bailout. But again, yeah, so, like you said, it's going to be so hard to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think we're super close to getting it all situated. And so you have to be careful where you're how much value you're putting on certain pieces of information. It could be coming from a person. It could be coming from a, you know, we're starting to get a handful of coaches. Is it coming from a coach? Is it coming from a player? Is it coming from a number on a screen in terms of percentages of getting to the kitchen or winning firefights against a certain player? What constitutes an actual firefight? Like, all of those things are tough. And we need that information. We need those numbers, but it's going to be a building process to clean them up in the appropriate way to make it as valuable as possible for the people that are taking in this information.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big props to those guys at Real Clear Stats. I mean, that's a big project, man, to break down stats within pickleball and data, because it's so nuanced. It's pretty subjective, like we talked about, even in the scenario you mentioned of, you know, who's responsible for that error. Is it force? Is it unforced? Is it a person that left it high? There's just a ton of nuance. And I think just what they're doing right now is super valuable, and I think it'll continue to get better. And yeah, big props to them on taking on a very hard project.
No, I agree completely. It had to start somewhere, and I think they do an awesome job. And yeah, it's a process, as we, you know, just spent the last 11 minutes talking about. Yeah, great place to start, really quality company. And I think that the information is just going to get cleaner and cleaner moving forward. But it's not going to be fully clean next week. So that's just part of the deal.
Are there any other things that surprised you in the draft? I mean, obviously I think there's some new people in Premier. Any surprising picks that you saw?
No, I think full on surprising. No, it's just a battle of solid vets versus shiny new toy. And like in 10 years, it's going to be hard to come out of nowhere, but you can come out of nowhere now. That's kind of like the hope of the pro pickleball player, you know, and that's why you see these qualifiers so dense with players, because there really is a shot in this moment. So from a GM perspective, especially when you're talking about 3-year contracts, you're talking about possible keepers on your squad, like it is so hard to balance performance for a long period of time, exactly what you're going to get to the shiny new toy. And I think, you know, some GMs and owners handle that better than others, but there is always going to be just that, oh man, what could this girl be? What could this guy be? And to perfectly be able to value that with someone who is consistent and are what they are and has probably already played their best pickleball because they've been around, because they're whatever, 33, and they've been around for 7 years, is just extremely difficult to do in the moment, especially when you're talking about growth in a variety of ways. There is slow, steady growth. There is giant jumps, and then they plateau growth. Then there's giant jump followed by a giant jump followed by a giant jump in the guy or girl's top 10. So all of that is very much in play where this sport stands right now. And I cannot describe to you how difficult it is to evaluate talent and what is correct for your team. Probably some blend of both. High floor players with high ceiling players makes the most sense, in my opinion.
Yeah. And talking about players making big jumps and getting results. And like you said, there's so many qualifiers, because you're right. There is a reasonable opportunity, if you're talented, to make the jump and get some quality wins and get some points and break through. It's as we're seeing, I mean, we have the APP pre-qualifiers, qualifiers, main draw. Like it's getting incredibly more challenging to break through like that, because the depth it's getting deep. And even watching the pre-qualifiers, I'm like, oh, these teams are pretty, like, these are good players. So there's lots of good players. We have seen a couple breakthroughs, especially at the PPA in Cary. Like we mentioned earlier, Xiaomei and Augie getting to Championship Sunday. I wouldn't even say it's arguably the upset of the year on the women's side. It's the upset of all upsets, I think, right? With Sarah Ansberry and was it Audrey Bonata?
Yes, that's correct. And
beating Rohrabacher and Anna Bright.
And Ansberry's not an up-and-comer. she's literally a legend of the game. She's been around forever. So for her to get that upset, she's not the new shiny toy. She's the consistent, solid vet that beat the I mean, they're clearly not up-and-comers. They're very established, Rohrabacher and Anna Bright. But they're so much less tenured than Ansberry is to the game of pickleball. It's a wild upset. And so it's so hectic, right? When you think you have it somewhat figured out, some wild, wild stuff happens. And like you mentioned, Rob Augie Guh and Xiaomei Martinez Vic, those guys are smooth as silk. They're like, often when you have two guys like that have playing as long as they have, especially with the singles prowess of Xiaomei, They're flailing around. They got arms and legs going everywhere. They're short hop driving from the midcourt for a few months. These guys are making good decisions. They are smooth in the midcourt. They are getting to the kitchen line with a variety of drops and drives, and they are under control when they get there. So it's insanely impressive what they did this past weekend. And yeah, I mean, Augie Gah, he has physical skills. He has smarts. He hasn't been playing that long. And he has pretty ridiculous hand speed from what I've seen so far in the handful of matches that I've watched. So when you have one or two things, you know, you sure, you're going to grow. But when you have two, three, four, five things working in your favor, you can make big leaps. And I mean, the dude's played probably 10 tournaments or less, and he's in Championship Sunday in a fully stacked PPA draw. That's silly stuff. And that is giving major hope to the qualifiers and the pre-qualifiers playing on Mondays and Tuesdays that I could be that guy. And this is a special time in pickleball. I love every minute of it. And I hope it stays this way for a while. But maybe in 5 years, you know, everybody's 6'3", 190 pounds, plays the same way and does the same things, and that's what's going to give us success. But we just have no idea, Rob. No idea.
Yeah, and it's been interesting with Xiaome, because obviously, as we always see with tennis converts coming over, is the singles translates quickly, then usually mix and men's last. But I think Xiaome has been unique in respect to his men's, I would say his men's results have been better than mixed, right? Has he had any really big mixed results?
No, I mean, I think you're right. I know he's played quite a bit with Jill Braverman, and I think that they have had, maybe we'll call it middling, where they beat a solid team or two, but no real deep runs. And, you know, I agree. That is the progression. We talk about it all the time. Mixed last for women, men's last for men. So, yeah, that he, and I remember this like 8 months ago, I was hitting with him just briefly, but before his partner got there or something, the day before the tournament started. And there's no wasted motion. It's smooth. He can counter and he can block. He's not just countering as hard as he can every single time. And I just kind of noted that in my mind, like, all right, this dude's been playing doubles for 8 months and he's pretty smooth. That is something that I like. Yeah, it's wild. And I mean, they played so well together. They were even dinking to the middle of the court against Matt Wright and James Ignatowicz, which is dangerous. Good against Matt, because you don't want to hit to his forehand out wide. He has a lot of options. But James's forehand in the middle off the bounce is really good, and he can whip through the zone up the middle. But they had a big lefty forehand on the right in Augie Gah and a quality left-sided right-hander in Xiaome. And James wasn't getting it through those paddles up the middle. And he had a bit of, what exactly should I do? I love pulling triggers, but it's not working against these guys. I'm not much of a grinder, even though his soft game's gotten better. And I could kind of see that mental squeeze on him that Xiaome and Augie put on James. And it was a special performance from those two.
Yeah, it was a interesting week. And I think that's what makes, you know, these tournaments fun, is when you have upsets and you have new people getting through. And but definitely an unusual week to see, you know, Anna Bright and James Ignatowicz go out kind of on the same day pretty early on in both events, men's and mixed. So yeah, obviously tough weekend for them, but I'm sure they're going to bounce back, and it's you know, it's fun to watch. It makes it fun to see.
Yeah, of course. It's a blend of new faces challenging the established guard and the high seeds. So, you know, I think Ben and Anna Lee had some fire in their bellies. They put on awesome performances this weekend, but we had tons of new faces, and it was not a great tournament for two seeds as several of them went down. So what a blend to have fresh faces to see if they can get all the way to the finish line against the top seeds. Those are good storylines instead of everyone being a familiar face, which is cool in its own right, but, you know, can get a bit stale, you know, from a viewer's perspective. So what a blend and what a weekend for pickle.
And it's going to get a little even a little deeper on the PPA side, as the Johnson Five played their last tournament on the APP side this past weekend in Delray. J-Dub and Dylan taking taking the men's title over Andre and Tardio. You got Millie and Georgia also coming back over. So PPA is just going to be that much more deep. And yeah, it's going to be fun to watch and have all of them at those tournaments, because again, I mean, it created, like, you usually have J-Dub and Dylan getting to those finals pretty regularly, pretty consistently. But with them out, it opens that door for guys like Augie and Xiaomei to get a big result, and obviously helped them here.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, even just the draft prep for MLP, you know, just squeezing in, I think I'm right that Millie went challenger. Yeah, she did. But the other four were premier. So just adding Gabe, Dylan and J-Dub to the player pool, like, completely changes the draft. So,
oh yeah.
And it's the same thing in a standard PPA tournament with the draw. It's like you squeeze in a top two or three team, or a top whatever Georgia and J-Dub are on the mix side, like, that drastically affects the draw and makes it even that much tougher for those kind of pop-up newbies to have success. So, man, it's deep. So much talent, just razor thin edges, especially on a physical side, and it's only going to continue to be harder and harder.
Yeah, I was surprised a little bit. So I think J-Dub went 12 in the draft and Dylan went 13. I was surprised with the amount of guys and the guys that did go in front of Dylan. I thought he should have been higher. I think Dylan's a little underrated still. I think he's better than people give him credit for on the left. You don't get to see it that often, obviously, in men's ever, really. But in mixed, you do. I think 13 is the value pick for Dylan.
No, you pair him with Andre. That's pocket aces. So I think that's really the battle in Premier. As you go, you have a chance to go pocket aces with two fellas, or do you go a more standard, what is it? Male, female, female, male. That's a common pattern as well with the kind of the depth of the player pool. But yeah, no, I get it. And possibly it could be some previous MLP results that dipped Dylan and JW a couple slots down, as especially JW, you know, love the kid, phenomenal skill set, but maybe not necessarily the energy player that has had success in the MLP format. So yeah, 12. Yeah, I think a lot of people were like, oh, JW at 12. Oh, Dylan at 13. You know, that's pretty far down there. So I would imagine that probably some GMs knocked them in that regard. And I'm not sure if being knocked that far down to double digits picks was the right play, as they clearly have plenty of game.
Yeah. Last kind of question on MLP, Adam, and then we can hit the tip and then we can wrap things up here. And this is just a purely out of curiosity question, because I don't know kind of what's the situation and how it played into the draft, but I was under the assumption that some players aren't going to have to play all the MLP events. Are there players that don't have to play all of them? And what does that look like in terms of finding replacements for the other events?
Right, so it's all due diligence by the individual teams. So they kind of had a couple different types of contracts, and it was just kind of listed out on the player report. So you basically, you had to contact the player or talk to the player about their specific contract negotiations. And I mentioned there's a couple different types of contract. So that was a big part of it, and. Premier gets first crack at the free agent wire, and you can trade in between Challenger and Premier. So a couple slight differences, but you just had to know. And if someone was like, no, I can't play more than four or six or whatever the number was, you had to value them properly and take them at the right spot and know that you're going to need a fill in for a tournament or two. So Yeah, there was a lot of moving parts, a lot going on from a variety of perspectives for this draft and kind of the lead up to it. And I think given the circumstances, it was quality and a good job. And I think everyone's ready to get on court and put that MLP product back to the masses, as I think it's a very good product.
Agreed. And I hope this is the last draft. I hope that was the last draft. And it's it's drops, pickups. I think we could still have a lot of new talent come into the league, which is going to be fun. But yeah, excited to see it again come early May, man. Shoot, it's only a month away now, so it'll be quick. But let's go right into the tip of the day, and then we'll wrap this baby up.
Tip of the day. And my tip of the day, Robert, is to mix your paces in a variety of shots. And I think that from a pro perspective, sure, this can be very effective, but of course the pros are going to handle things better. I'm more talking about those mid-level players, pretty much anywhere from 3-0 to 4-5. And it really can happen on a variety of shots. I think everyone out there has played that former tennis player that really gets into a groove. And you give them the same ball, whether it's on a return or a variety of shots, they just get locked in with their technique and their contact points the same every time. They are going to do damage. So if you can change the eye level or possibly some of the pace, and this could be on return, this could be kitchen to kitchen attacks. I think a lot of players are just thinking of, oh, I'm gonna mix up my spins, which sure, that can be solid. A lot more can go wrong, I think, when you're talking about, brushing over the ball, hacking underneath the ball, trying to create some side spin or something to get your opponent out of rhythm. It can literally just be from changing their eye level or changing the timing of their stroke. And it's an absolutely huge thing for me. And a couple of the things that I'm thinking of to do this, one is grip strength is a good way to do it. So I don't get too extreme. I'm never rarely at a 1 or a 2 or a 9 or a 10 in terms of 1 to 10 grip strength. But taking just a little firmness off from the kitchen line can allow you to take some pace off and still allow that ball to stay in. And one of the big mistakes that I see from players looking to take pace off the ball is that they fully decelerate when they are hitting. All right. So what I mean by that is you take the paddle back and then almost at contact, you just kind of slow it down or stop. And I think that a lot can go wrong when you do that. The best way to take pace off the ball is grip strength, as I mentioned, or smoothing out your stroke throughout the entirety of the stroke. You want to keep kind of the same paddle head speed through. You just start a little slower and smooth out that stroke as opposed to starting fast and then just stopping the paddle and hoping that that takes pace off of the ball. What do you think about that, Robert?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I like to do this. I think just this, probably the most simple example is on return to serve, like you mentioned, is you don't want to give them the same exact return every time, especially at that level, right? Because they start to feel the pattern, same contact point on that third shot drop or the drive, whatever it may be. And if you're cranking them, it's also tough to get all the way to the kitchen line with how fast the paddles are now. And how poppy they are. So, and very common thing in at that level is to not move through the return. It's to stop, hit, then go, which means you're probably going to be a step or two behind the kitchen line, not getting all the way up there. So, we talked about it, Adam. I think an underrated way to handle returns is to short hop the return because you're already moving through it. You're going to get to the kitchen line. It's fine if it has some height on it. But even this weekend, guys are cranking serves, and I'm liking the high return that's landing kind of deep because it's giving me time to get all the way in versus just cranking it and then being a step or two behind the kitchen line.
Yeah, and you can even drive through those returns, just don't do it every time. So
Yep.
float, you can float a couple deep, make sure you get to your spot, but if you drive through your returns every single time to a quality former tennis player and the ball is just right on their hip every single time, that's trouble. That
Yeah.
is going to be they are going to get into rhythm. They are going to drive through the ball nicely. So a blend. I don't want you never to hit a penetrating, more line drive return, but make sure you mix that in with some variety and yep. some deeper, slower returns. And, you, of course, people love to talk about hitting through your return at a regular ground stroke pace or cutting underneath and going with slice. And really, as long as you're mixing it up and not doing the same thing every time to your opponent, I think you can get a lot of benefits in that regard. We don't want our opponents to be in rhythm. When they are, we are at a disadvantage. So if we can two floaty returns, drive through one, and it sounds so simple. Oh, this is plain. Oh, of course, that's a quality strategy. I see so many people giving their opponents the exact same shot over and over and over again. And I think there is a lot of safe ways to change up the pace and keep your opponent guessing on exactly what they're going to get.
Yeah, and I think there's been a lot of talk on, just to kind of close this out, there's been a lot of talk on, you know, giving slice returns helps the, you know, helps them on their thirds roll over it and get a lot of topspin on it. And that's a fact. But I still think the slice return's effective if you're able to knife it and keep it low. Because, you know, if I'm hitting a flat return forehand or slight topspin return, the ball's still sitting up pretty high for them to rip a third if they want to. But if I'm hitting a really low slice and it's staying down, that's a tougher ball to really get underneath if they're hitting it from, call it, their shin. And the ball is going to have to come up. So, and it's hard to get it from that low to dip just over the net into the kitchen. So I think a slice is still good as long as it's not kind of sitting up and you're really going through it. And that's going to take some practice, but I still think it's a super effective return.
I agree. I totally agree. And really just want to stay out of that middle zone. So if you can get that knifing, penetrating slice, like you said, that stays low, or even the one that's floating deep in the court where they have to create all of their yep. own pace, both of those are tough. You just want to avoid that slice that sits right around the hip or the midsection, where they can use your spin and use your pace from their comfortable contact point. When they have to, like I said, create their own pace or get underneath the ball and have some better timing from that low slice, that makes it more difficult for them. And I think that you are going to get easier first volleys and you are going to create some errors from your opponent when you are able to do that.
Agree. And I think we're going to continue, obviously, giving these tips each week. Would love to hear in the comments. I mean, we're happy to just bring ideas to the table, but, you know, this is for your benefit. So we would love to hear what you have in terms of questions regarding of tip of the day and what you would like us to cover next week and the following week. So put it down in the comments of what you would like us to cover for the tip of the week, and we will do that. And it doesn't have to be just tip of the week. Let us know what you'd like us to cover in general, and we will cover that in future episodes. But you're here,
guide us.
Like, subscribe. Selkirk does an amazing job putting on this podcast, and we appreciate that. And liking, subscribing helps us continue to do it. So good episode, Adam. This is, it feels right. And man, it feels right.